This is famous minor television personality John Hodgman. You're listening to The Media Twits with Mark Glazer and Rafat Ali.
So welcome to another edition of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. This episode of The Media Twits is sponsored by the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, which is accepting applications for its entrepreneurial journalism programs. Get more details at bit.ly/CUNYJSchool. That's bit.ly/CUNYJSchool. And joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are you doing today?
Good, where you were until this morning, right?
Yeah, I was out in New York actually earlier this week. I came in last night back to San Francisco, but I was there for the Poynter Ethics. Craig Kinnexon and Poynter had this kind of new ethics for journalism in the digital age with a lot of kind of big name thinkers and conversations. Dan Gilmore, Jeff Jarvis made like a short kind of cameo appearance, and there was a lot of discussions. I thought it was good that, you know, sometimes you get tired of kind of seeing the same people at every event, the same speakers, but I thought they did a good job of moderating and kind of bringing in some people from the audience. There was some talk about free speech, actually a big discussion about the thing we talked about on a previous podcast about free speech and hate speech on all the different platforms, and Vadim Laversick was there from Facebook to kind of answer everyone's kind of concerns about what happens on Facebook.
Yeah, and it was at Paley Center, which is a great venue. I know you liked it a lot.
Yeah, that was my first time at Paley Center, and then we had a mixer downstairs in the lobby. And yeah, it's a really nice venue. And I was surprised to hear from you that that they use Paley for things like watching soccer games, and just like that it's a real gathering place for media people.
Yeah, and not just media people. It's free for literally free for anybody. They have – it also serves as a museum of sorts, both the one in here in New York, and they have the Paley Center in L.A., which is more entertainment focused. So anybody who's listening and hasn't been – if you live in one of those towns, it would be nice. They do have you check the website. They have different sort of shows going on, and it's all of them that I remember are free. Sometimes they have some things that they screen and they charge money for, but mostly it's free.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that came up at the ethics thing was things that I think both of us have dealt with a lot, which is, you know, how do you run a business, a new kind of journalism business or content business online, when you're really small and you're kind of the publisher, editor, writer, salesperson, marketer, you know, when you end up doing so many roles yourself, you know, how do you find an ethical balance or a way to deal with conflicts when you're just such a small operation? I know you dealt with that a lot.
In my previous company, Paid Content, yeah, I did a lot. I mean, in this case, we are more of a traditional company in the sense that we're separated quite a bit, even, and also because we are not focused on any kind of revenues at this point, so those issues haven't come up yet. But yeah, certainly it's a ongoing issue with a lot of small, either single person or very small team.
So we have a pretty special show today. I got to interview last week John Hodgman, the minor TV celebrity, as he describes himself.
Minor. No, he's big. Among a certain set, he's huge.
I know. Among media twits, for sure. He and technology and kind of comedy geeks, he's definitely kind of a big figure. And on Twitter. So I got to talk to him about, he has a new book called That Is All, kind of about the coming apocalypse, the 2012 apocalypse. It's coming in December. And the audiobook that he's delivering with it. And then we'll talk about Apple's new big slate of announcements, including the iPad mini, and just, you know, was it another underwhelming kind of announcement, and how these kind of smaller tablets fit into our lives, these kind of 7-inch tablets that have come out from Amazon and from Google and from BlackBerry, and now Apple's joining the fray. So the question is, you know, when Christmas comes up, you know, which should you buy? Why should you buy it? So we'll have Nicole Lee from Engadget and Matt Buchanan from BuzzFeed. Comedian, author, and Apple pitchman John Hodgman recently released his latest book, That Is All, the third tome in his Complete World Knowledge trilogy. The book includes sections on wine and sports, deranged millionaires, and the end of the world, which will of course happen on December 21st, the Mayan New Year. Hodgman is known for being the PC on the popular Mac versus PC ad campaign for Apple, and has been a longtime correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Welcome to the Media Twits, John.
Thank you so much, Mark. Everything you said is, for the most part, true.
That's important.
It is.
Now, the book, That Is All, is it, how much of that is true? How much is truthiness?
Very little of it is true. The That Is All is the third and final book in a trilogy of what I call Complete World Knowledge, which began with a book called The Areas of My Expertise, which are trivia books and sort of fun compendia of fascinating true facts, with the exception that most of the facts in it are made up by me. So whereas other trivia books might have a list of, you know, U.S. presidents who were insomniacs or loved to play pinochle, I have a list of U.S. presidents who had hooks for hands. So, for example, FDR, no one knew that FDR had a hook for a hand because it was shaped like a wheelchair.
So with your book, a lot of it is, you don't really have to guess whether it's true or false. You can just assume right off the bat that it's made up.
No, I make an important point at the beginning to say this is fake, because the truth may be stranger than fiction, but it's never as strange as lies.
Good point.
So yes, yeah, so the three books are, you know, sort of outline a kind of invented, an alternate universe America in which presidents had hooks for hands, and the United States was briefly controlled in the 1930s by a band of hobos, and in which I almost implausibly of all became accidentally a famous minor television personality on The Daily Show, which is partly true.
What's the accidental part of that?
Well, I had written the first book at a time in my life when, even though I loved movies and television and popular culture, I had resigned myself quite happily to what I was, a writer for magazines like the New York Times Magazine and Men's Journal, and of humor for websites like McSweeney's. And I thought that very happily would be my career for the rest of my life. And most of all, with these books, I thought these are books that allow me to tell jokes and also write little weird stories at the same time. There are moments in the books of fiction writing as close as I can emulate, that is to say. And then I went on The Daily Show to promote the first book because Jon Stewart really loves hobo humor. And it went well, and quite unexpectedly, he asked me to come back and contribute comedy as the show's resident expert, because what these books are about basically is the devolution of the de-evolution of the term expert. Anyone who claims to be an expert in media right now tends to be taken at face value as one. And that quite unexpectedly led me on a career. As I say, the most implausible part of my books is that I became a famous minor television personality as a result.
The format of the books are really interesting. I mean, you can really just dig into, there's so many little footnotes and tables and graphs and all kinds of funky things to it. It reminds me a little bit about the way McSweeney's sometimes does things. What were your other influences in those kind of bizarre formatting?
Well, I mean, I received a tremendous amount of encouragement from Dave Eggers to write humor for the McSweeney's website after I quit being a literary agent. And so the humor column, the advice column that I wrote for McSweeney's was called Ask a Former Professional Literary Agent. And stylistically and in terms of my personal preoccupations, I could not have had a more inspirational partner than Dave and the entire McSweeney's enterprise. And then as well, I was, you know, particularly in the use of footnotes, I was influenced by David Foster Wallace, who broke my brain in half and put it back together again with the use of a single footnote in his essay about cruising in the Caribbean, when he discussed someone having a home skeet shooting stadium. And he had a little footnote, and down at the bottom, the footnote itself consisted entirely of an exclamation point, which I just, it was the funniest thing I had ever thought of. And then Borges, who is a big influence for me as well, the Argentine writer and fabulist, Jorge Luis Borges, who used to write short stories in the form of authoritative literary essays with footnotes and annotations and so on. And that kind of gamesmanship of presenting fiction as fact, of being serious but at the same time being playful, all of that influenced me tremendously. And by influence, I really mean freed me.
Yeah, I mean, because when you look at something that has footnotes and has all this kind of structure to it, it screams out that it's something authoritative. And if you're going to break down the idea of an expert, then what better way to do it than to look even more expert?
Yeah, exactly so. And you know, the we all have an idea of what we want to do creatively if we're creative people. And a lot of times the real breakthrough you have is when you give up the idea of what you want to do and just do the thing that you're good at. And both Borges and Eggers and David Foster Wallace all sort of made me say, oh, look, it's okay to be playful. It's okay to be deceptive. It's okay to have fun. And so these books, which were designed entirely to be fun, also contain some of the best and most interesting writing that I've ever done.
Now, you said you were a literary agent. You were also giving this kind of advice from a literary agent. What do you think about the way that now, with the rise of kind of ebooks and self-publishing and everything, you know, we had someone on MediaShift write a story about, you know, literary agents still have a place, you know, in the publishing world. What do you think about literary agents now? I mean, are they the kind of job that could get eliminated because of technology?
I think that literary agents have more of a place than ever, because what's getting replaced by technology is distribution. And publishing, even in the 1990s, when I worked in book publishing, had become a rather lethargic industry that relied almost exclusively on its monopoly of distribution as its way of doing business. So much of what we identify romantically with book publishing, oak-clad or, you know, wood-paneled offices with thoughtful editors nurturing alcoholic writers through bouts of depression to create the greatest work of all time, offshored by book publishing, which had been bought up by bigger and bigger media corporations, such that editorial advice, career management, simply the simple psychiatric help that editors would offer their typically neurotic and sociopathic authors had all been offshored to literary agents. And the literary agents had and still have, I think, the most nimble position in book publishing. They find people who do good things, they help them to do it, and they find markets for them. There are more markets than ever before. And in fact, I think that a literary agency could easily become essentially a small publisher for its clients quite effectively in the not too distant future.
So it really takes the agent themselves kind of thinking differently and not being about pitching big publishers, but about thinking about where they can get the work put out online.
Whether you're a writer, whether you're a musician, whether you're a comedian, whether you're a famous minor television personality, we all have to think differently now. You know, about how we get our material out into the world, and how we're going to make money off of it. And yes, I agree. Yes, agents have to think differently. Everyone does have to think differently. I think that it's a tremendously positive time for people who make things, and it's a much more challenging time for people who have traditionally profited off of other people making things.
And part of that is social media. I know you're pretty prolific on Twitter. What do you get out of that relationship on going on there all the time? I mean, for a comedian, it seems like it's just tailor-made with like just short kind of one-liners that you can spit out pretty much any time of day or night.
Twitter has really brought back the one-liner as a mainstream form of comedy. You know, with the incredible comedy of like Rob Delaney, or for that matter, Kelly Oxford, who was someone out in the wilderness of entertainment, as it were. You know, a woman at home with her kids who had an incredible sense of humor and otherwise. And who did not live in New York or Los Angeles, to the best of my knowledge, and otherwise would never have been heard, now suddenly has this enormous following on Twitter. I think it's an amazing opportunity and for people who are creative to reach and cultivate an audience. And if Twitter isn't a tool that speaks to your personal whatever it is that inspires you, there are dozens and dozens of other tools out there for you to reach and cultivate an audience in whatever you might do, to make comedy, to make music, to make fiction, to make whatever it is. I think Twitter is the one that speaks most to me because I'm lazy and I don't like to write much longer than 40 characters anyway. And so it's been a tremendous opportunity for me to not only reach an audience and let them know what I'm thinking about and doing and having for lunch and when I'm going to take a nap, but also to discover incredible voices out there in what truly would have been just 10 years ago, from an entertainment world point of view, the utter wilderness of the rest of the country that is not a major city on either coast.
What about Facebook and Google Plus and other social platforms? Are you just too lazy to get into them, or do you find value in those too?
I think that you put it quite right that I am too lazy to get into them. I mean, in a sense, I signed up for Facebook when I started hearing about that. I sort of obligatorily signed up for Google Plus. Neither one of them just clicked with me the way Twitter did. I think the thing that turned me off to Facebook initially was that it was work. I had to approve the people who wanted to be my friend on Facebook. And that not only, you know, adds up in a day full of making up fake facts and taking naps and so on, just in terms of time, but it also made me very, you know, anxious and self-conscious. I want to please everyone. I don't want to have to approve or disapprove of anybody in the world. There are people who make it a point in their creative careers to maintain a presence, a meaningful and lively presence on every one of these social network platforms. And that takes up a lot of time that I would rather use making something or taking a rest from making something. And all I can offer to people out there in the social network world is my authentic self. And my authentic self basically uses Twitter and sort of offshores to other things as well. I mean, I have a website which is run by Tumblr, for example, which sort of merges the world of traditional old style early 2000s blogging and social networking, and that works very well for me as well. But that all just pumps out to my Twitter account primarily.
So, and I guess the big question that we're looking at now is there's going to be this new iPad mini that comes out from Apple. Are you the kind of person who is kind of first in line for something like that, or do you pay someone to go online for you, or are you just not interested?
I certainly there was a time when I might get the iPad mini very quickly, maybe dozens of them, and tile my bathroom with them. Now that I am still very much an Apple supporter, but someone who is no longer professionally associated with the company, I go out and buy stuff, wait in my own lines and buy stuff with my own money. And make my own choices. And I think that you know, I actually am still operating on an iPad 1. So it is time for an upgrade to an iPad, a new iPad of some kind. And I'll certainly look at this iPad mini. And again, it's sort of like any other technology tool. For me, it's sort of like, does this click? Does this answer some need that I didn't even know that I wanted? Do I want to use this? And if that's how I feel about the iPad mini, I will buy it. Otherwise, I'll probably get the new iPad.
Now that you're not paid by Apple, I mean, even if you were, let's say, but I mean, do you feel like there's the life cycle of these kinds of things just seems to be getting shorter and shorter to the point where you feel like you have to upgrade everything pretty much every year?
No, I don't think that. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the reasons that I was so happy to be associated with Apple, for those ads, I mean, truly, personally happy. I've been an Apple user since 1984. I know exactly why I use them. It is because these devices do answer questions I didn't know that I was asking. They offer things, and they offer solutions that I didn't know that I was seeking, and they fill roles in my life that I didn't realize that I needed filled, and they are a pleasure to use, and thus become very effective creative tools for me. It's similar to Twitter. If I see a tool that is useful and fun and inspiring to me, I'm going to use it. And almost with very, very few missteps, Apple has always created products that do that for me. I mean, the iPhone was, I think, in a way, such a total revelation to everyone who touched it, such a game changer in the way we not only think of devices, but offload our memory and our contacts and our way of dealing with the world to these ever-present devices that they instantly became part of ourselves, such that we don't even notice them anymore. We forget just how revolutionary it was to hold that thing. I will buy a device when it serves a new function that I didn't have before. So I'm not the sort of person who will go out and buy the new thing every time, but if I see a new generation of a thing that's like, yeah, that I didn't realize I needed that, then I will certainly go out and buy it. Apple has a very high, very successful track record with me of impressing me in that way, in a way that very few other technology companies ever have. And certainly, I hope, I'm glad that they are introducing new devices and new technologies with a certain frequency of pace, because that means I know they're always trying to push to the next thing. Does that mean that I will keep pace with them every time? Not necessarily. I sure do wish well, that's all I'm going to say about that.
Okay. So one last question about kind of John Stewart and working with him. One thing as kind of a media watcher that I think constantly amazes me is just the popularity of John Stewart and Stephen Colbert and what they've created as like as a different way of looking at news. I mean, how do you explain their popularity and the fact that so many people respond and say that, they're the primary news source, that that's where they get their news, and from a fake news show.
Well, I mean, it's not a fake news show. It is a fake news. It is a comedy show on the comedy on Comedy Central, right? And so it is obviously satiric and hilarious, but it is not made up. In fact, I believe that I know for a fact the Daily Show has, and I suspect that Colbert does as well, a team dedicated to making sure that every fact that is uttered on the show is true and verifiable. Aside from, the fake facts that I put out into the world, which are marked as fake. Do you see what I mean?
Right.
If you were to watch that show, you would obviously get a point of view, and I would hope a lot of hilarious chuckles and ha-has. But if you learn information from that show, I can guarantee you right now that information is true. So in that sense, I am not troubled at all if people are gleaning news from it, because I think it's just as effective to glean news from a comedy show like The Daily Show as it is to glean news from a rage and paranoia generating device such as Fox, quote unquote, news. Do you see what I mean? Both
Yeah.
have a kind of angle. Now, in terms of why it's popular, that is also, there's not a hard question to answer. Both John and Stephen are incredibly talented, and both John and Stephen are incredibly authentic in what they do. Now, John is always John, and The characters that surround him, like me as the resident expert slash deranged millionaire, or any of the full-time correspondents who come on the show to spout insanity, John is the still point that reacts to them. When he is speaking to camera, he is speaking as himself. And even when Stephen is speaking to camera in character as quote-unquote Stephen Colbert, he plays a game where he drifts in and out of character such that you know where he's coming from. They're engaging with the news in a very honest way, and they are not axe grinding in any way. The Daily Show is not a show about ideology. It is a show that does not advocate an ideology. It detests hypocrisy. And wherever that is found, The Daily Show will illuminate that. That happens in both Republican and Democratic sides, and especially in media coverage of politics. There's tons of ridiculous hypocrisy there to expose and illuminate. And that's, I think, something that people who otherwise are watching the news and feeling manhandled a little bit by the hidden agendas of those news broadcasts, when they watch The Daily Show, there is no hidden agenda. There is an open agenda to make you laugh and to simply say, this is going on. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, I mean, they've really made media criticism fun and entertaining, which I don't think anybody else has really pulled off before.
What could be more valuable, honestly, than media criticism at this time? You know, I don't meta about it, but you know, there are facts in the world, no matter how much I try to deny them myself personally. And we need a media that will reveal those facts. And when the media is more involved in creating a storyline or a narrative than relating what is true, it is good to have a watchdog of one kind or another. And isn't it great to have one that is so consistently funny?
Definitely. Well, thanks for your time. I really appreciate you coming on Media Twits.
My pleasure.
So now let's talk about the dizzying array of tablets, especially the 7-inch variety. There was a time when, early on with tablets, when they were just limited to the Apple iPad and some lesser imitators. But now Amazon has hit hard on the low end with a smaller Kindle Fire, and other competitors such as the Google Nexus 7 have brought Android to the low-cost realm at just $200 and less. So Apple recently, this week, fought back with its own smaller model, the iPad mini at 7.9 inches, but costing $325, which is a bit pricier than its competition. And what about the new Microsoft Surface as far as larger tablets go? Our guests are Nicole Lee, who's been covering technology since 2005 with stints at Wired, Gizmodo, CNET, This Week in Tech, and now in Gadget, where she writes about gadgets of all kinds. Welcome, Nicole.
Hey, glad to be here.
We also have Matt Buchanan, who's the editor of BuzzFeed's tech vertical, FWD. Buchanan was previously the deputy editor of Gawker's Gizmodo, has contributed to American Photo, Bloomberg, the New York Times Diners Journal, and Popular Mechanics. Welcome back to the show, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Matt, you know, the last time we had you guys on, we were talking about the iPhone 5 and kind of what we thought were its shortcomings. You know, even though we knew it was going to sell and fly off the shelves, you know, mm-hmm. we weren't totally excited by it. Is this the same feeling you had about the iPad mini when it came out, that, you know, okay, we've been hearing about it forever, here it is? I mean, how did you feel about it?
I mean, so in some ways it's even less surprising than an iPhone 5, right? Because it is very much an iPad but smaller, and it's using a lot of the iPad 2's guts. It's not a Retina display, it's using an A5 chip. But at the same time, so it's not exciting in a lot of ways, but this is very much something that I think Apple is going to sell, you know, by the truckload as fast as they can make them in China. So I think there is a little bit of that, because it is something that is very much kind of an evolution. But at the same time, you know, it's worth appreciating who they've made this for and why they made it.
Is that what you felt like, Nicole, as well? I mean, I've seen some reviewers kind of come out slamming, you know, Apple for this and saying it's just, you know, it's not, the specs aren't so great, the price is too high, et cetera. And then, you know, on PC Magazine, they came out and kind of defended it and said people are still going to buy it. You know, it still basically blows away the competition and Android, that the apps and the ecosystem are just the best. I mean, is it, where do you come down on this?
I think it's one of those questions where if you come from it from a purely sort of scientific perspective, we say, okay, you know, this obviously doesn't have the quad core that the Nexus 7 has. It doesn't have the Retina display that the Nexus 7 has, and it's not, and it costs almost $100 more, right? So from a very purely sort of outsider perspective, you think, oh well, it's clearly, it's clearly not as good as the Nexus 7. But then I think you had a link to the ZDNet article, and I think they make a really good point. If let's say all of these tablets were free, which one would you choose? And I think a lot of people would choose the iPad mini, and I think it's mostly because they already know what the ecosystem is, and it kind of depends on whether you're an Android ecosystem person or an iOS ecosystem person. And a lot of people are sort of more leaning towards the iOS thing just because they're more used to the apps, they're more used to the games that are available on iOS, and the tablet apps on Android are still not as fully fleshed out, I think, as the ones on iOS. But it kind of depends. Like one of my friends, like, he's super into his Nexus 7, and it's mostly because all he does on it is just like surf the web and email and a few games here and there. So for those sort of purposes, I think going cheaper is better. But then, you know, some people just really like iPads and they would probably go for it no matter what.
I wonder, this is Rafat, and this question for any of you. I wonder if there's any study or any kind where, like, if you own an iPhone, then you will, then most of them, their 99% chances are going to buy an iPad. Or if you own an Android phone, 99% chances you're going to buy an Android tablet. Is that what you would think would be the case?
There aren't studies on that, but you can definitely look at studies as to whether iPhone buyers, iPhone owners would be repeat purchasers of another iPhone. I think overwhelmingly that's been the case. And it makes sense if you have an iPhone, maybe less if you have an Android device because the paid ecosystem isn't as big there. But if you have an iPhone, you've had one for a couple of years and you've spent, you know, hundreds or even, you know, thousands of dollars on apps over the last few years, it makes far more sense to stay within that ecosystem and rather than having to repurchase and kind of look through a whole new app catalog. So it makes sense, you know, once you're in an ecosystem, you're going to stay in it. So I think one of the interesting challenges, I know we're not talking about Surface yet for Microsoft, right, is if, you know, they're essentially launching a new ecosystem for Windows, and it's hard, you know, if somebody already has an iPad, how do you get them to kind of come back to the Windows ecosystem after they've spent a bunch of money inside of Apple's world?
Yeah, what did you think? You had a very extensive kind of review of Microsoft Surface, and I know they're kind of on an advertising blitz now. And it looks, you know, it looks kind of exciting. It has this kind of cool flat keyboard pad type thing, and it looks really nice. But I guess you felt a little underwhelmed when you looked at it and really played around with it.
Well, the issue right now, and you know, there's sort of a question of like, why Microsoft timed the review units the way they did. Because, you know, when I had it, when all the other reviewers had it, there really wasn't very much in the App Store. And with Windows RT, which is the version of Windows on the Surface, it doesn't run old Windows apps. So what you're really restricted to is stuff, new stuff from the Windows Store. And there was a real paucity of apps during this time. And, you know, today with the launch, it's better. There's a New York Times app, there's a New Yorker app. So I think the vision Microsoft is offering is in a lot of ways more compelling than, you know, what Apple is offering with the iPad, right? Because they're talking about one version of Windows or, you know, Windows across a multitude of devices. And you have one device that kind of serves as your tablet and as your laptop. Obviously, we're generations away from enough power for that to really be like your one device for everybody. But, you know, that is a really compelling vision. And I think Surface, you know, I'm planning to go back to it in a month or two and kind of look at it again, because, you know, I wanted to accurately present the way, if you buy it today, this is what it's going to be like. But, you know, the question really is what it's going to be like in 2 or 3 months, especially because the Surface will run all of the new apps written for Windows 8. So we'll get a better picture of what that's going to look like. And in the past, this has been a problem for devices. Like the touchpad never really came back around. But I think if any device has a chance to really be much better in a few months, it'll definitely be Surface and these other new Windows tablets.
What was your take, Nicole? Did you get to check out Surface yet?
No, I haven't, unfortunately. The editor-in-chief of Engadget managed to do that. And after reading all the reviews, it's kind of interesting how they're sort of mixed. Like you said, Matt, like some are more in your camp where they appreciate the hardware, but the apps just seem lacking, and it just seems just not mature enough for you to plunk out that kind of money for a tablet system. And it's interesting because the Windows RT, that is the one that everyone reviewed recently, is a more of a tablet style thing. And they're coming out with something called a Surface Pro, and that's more of a actual computer type of thing. And I wonder if most consumers will actually understand there's like two different kinds of tablets, and they're both called Surface. And I think that's one of the things that Microsoft has to battle, this public reception. I think it looks really interesting, and I think it was really smart for Microsoft to have the whole touch cover thing integrated into the tablet system from the get-go, to sort of stamp the Surface as this is a productivity machine, this is an office machine, and you can do work on it, you know, compared to the iPad, blah, 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 right? But I do agree the app ecosystem is a huge problem, and especially because the Surface RT, you can't install traditional Windows 8 apps on it. It's like specific kinds of apps you can install on it. And it's true that today they just announced the New York Times app and the Kindle app, which will definitely increase the viability of it, I guess. But it's going to be an uphill climb, I think.
What do you think of some of the, and of course we'll hear next week what Google is, the new Nexus phone. I guess already a lot of details out about that. But if the screen size, if the tablets are getting smaller, and some of the Android ecosystem phones especially are getting bigger, are we just moving to one device that's just going to be slightly larger than a phone and slightly smaller than a mini?
I don't think so, because when you're talking about the kinds of things you can, even going from a 7-inch tablet to a 10-inch tablet, like, it's much different. That's when I went to Microsoft campus for that sort of behind the Surface event, Microsoft talked a lot about how they came to 10.6 inches is the precise size for the screen, because they had tried smaller than 10 inches and they went to 10.1, and they wound up at 10.6 because that tends to be the precise size at which you can do a keyboard where your hands don't overlap. So there's definitely distinctions in terms of what each screen size is more capable of. I think, you know, a 7-inch tablet is more natural for reading paperback style stuff. When you're talking about magazines, 10 inches seems better. And then, you know, I personally don't want a huge phone in my pocket. So I feel like, you know, I never really had a problem with the 3.5-inch screen on the last few generations of iPhone. But the 4-inch screen is nice, on the 5, and then there was a Windows Phone device, the Samsung Focus, that had a 4-inch screen. And I think that's sort of a happy medium between this more portable thing and something that gives you a little bit more real estate.
So what would you guys suggest for, let's say, the coming shopping season? I know buying gadgets for people is not always a good thing to do necessarily, just because you don't know their needs, but are there specific things when it comes to these kind of 7-inch devices? I mean, they seem more affordable, at least as far as a gift goes. But are there things about each one or each ecosystem that might be better for a different type of person or a different generation, or something that's easier versus more complicated?
I feel like if you're looking for a cheaper device for somebody who's more computer savvy, I feel like the Nexus 7 is a pretty decent device. The thing about the Amazon Kindle Fire HD, right, is it's something that's mostly designed for you to buy stuff from Amazon with. So what you're really buying for somebody is a commitment to buying more stuff from Amazon, whereas the tablets, you know, have a more productive capabilities, particularly when you're talking about the iPad and the Surface. So it sort of really depends on who you're looking at. And they, I mean, the one thing I'd really consider is what other devices they have, because if you have somebody that has a lot of Apple devices, maybe a Nexus 7 is not the best thing for them. On the other hand, the Amazon tablet is a little bit more platform agnostic. If you have a bunch of iOS stuff or Apple stuff or a bunch of Google stuff, the Kindle Fire can still kind of fit into that ecosystem, particularly because the Kindle stuff goes across, you know, everybody's platforms.
Would you agree, Nicole, or did you have another take on that?
Yeah, I think that's sound advice. You know, just definitely see it for the person's current you know, existing gadgets, and whether they're more of an iPhone person versus an Android person. And if, let's say, they're neither, that I would actually go for, you know, something like an Amazon thing, just because Amazon seems to cross the divide somewhat between the two.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
No problem.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. We want to thank my co-host, Rafat Ali, as well as our guests, John Hodgman, Nicole Lee, and Matt Buchanan, as well as our sponsor, the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. And we want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for helping to make this podcast possible. Be sure to keep up with all the polls, news, and events at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift, as well as our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab, and our new site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week with the Politics and Elections special.
Brings everyone down.